Brown. This is the Legion of Sports podcast coming to you from WSOE Studios in Elon, North Carolina. I'm Harrison Klein.
And I'm Jake Anthony.
Unfortunately, Chase Williams isn't able to be here this week, so it'll be just Jake and I. And because it's more of a quiet sports period right now, we're going to do something a little different. We're going to start with some debates about popular sports topics, and then we're going to do an NFL draft, basically, later in the show.
So we picked four topics, kind of broad sports questions that are kind of controversial in a sense. So we don't necessarily always agree with the side that we picked, but obviously we don't want to agree on the debates or else it wouldn't be very interesting. So we're going to start off with the first question, which would be, should the college football playoffs be expanded?
So I'm going to go with yes, I think they should be expanded. And I mean, personally, I think this is a pretty easy one because I think that for years, we've seen, it's been 5 or 6 years now that the playoff has been going on, and every year except, I think until this year, there's always been a debate between the 4-5 and even the 6 seed on who should get in. So, I mean, just right from the start, it allows for teams to, you know, right on the outside to have a chance and get in to compete for the championship. And then, you know, maybe there can be some interconference rivals, like let's say Michigan State, Ohio State, you can get Alabama, LSU, you know, some bigger rivalries that we really haven't seen play out in the playoffs because usually at most two, you know, it's usually pretty much one team per conference in there. And then, I mean, there's a lot of ways to do this. I think the best way to do this would be you have the five, so you basically, it's an 18 playoff where you have the five big conference winners, so Pac-12, Big Ten, Big 12, SEC, ACC, so the winner from each of those conferences. Then you have the best group of five teams, so this year would have been Memphis. And then you have two at-large bids. So this year it could have been the one seed would have been LSU against Memphis, which was the best group of five team as the 8 seed. Ohio State against Baylor, as Baylor would get the at-large bid. 3 versus 6 would be Clemson at the 3 against Oregon as at the 6 as the Pac-12 winner. And then the Big 12 winner is Oklahoma, the 4 seed, against Georgia, the 5 seed, and they would be the other at-large. So it gives more of an opportunity for these other teams, and then it's just better for college football because more games, and that's what the fans want at the end of the day.
So I'm going to take the other side and say no, it should not be expanded. The main reason behind not expanding the college football playoff is, to your point, to start off, there's always going to be controversies. So whether or not it's the controversy of the 4 seed being the final spot or the 8 seed, that at-large bid, you mentioned it being the 7 seed in Baylor this year, that's always going to be controversial a little bit in terms of the fans and how they feel. If we add double the amount of college football playoff games, then that allows for teams with 2 or 3 losses to potentially enter the playoff. This would really just make the regular season for college football way less meaningful. We've seen that you need to have near perfect seasons to make the playoff, which is what it should be. This year, Alabama didn't make the playoffs because of their late loss in the season, and they probably wouldn't have made it in an 8-team expansion either way, but it's just interesting to look at because the controversy is always going to be there, so whether or not that's Baylor or Wisconsin this year as that 7 seed, Wisconsin had 3 losses, Baylor had 2. It just, for me, it decreases the excitement in those final games of the regular season. Those conference championship games where only one winner can make it, and now we can potentially have those not mean as much, where if there's a Big Ten conference championship, then both teams are assumed to be getting a bid if there's 8 seeds, as opposed to the winner only gets a spot in the playoff.
Yeah, so I mean, just going off your points, I think I would argue that the regular season could almost become more meaningful because let's say you have a team lose one game early in the season, you know, usually they think that they're out of it, and then maybe they lose a second game. Usually, I mean, if a team has 2 losses, they're out of it. But I mean, let's say down the stretch you have 12 teams competing for 8 spots instead of just 6 competing for 4 in the end. So those last 2 or 3 weeks of the season is when everyone's really paying attention to a lot of college football games. A lot of teams are still playing for something, while right now you only have a few games each weekend that really mean something towards the end of the year. So I would argue it makes things more meaningful. And then also another big thing is that we don't really see too many out-of-conference early season matchups between the bigger schools. Like we saw Oregon and Auburn this year, And, you know, people are going to argue that Oregon losing that first game to Auburn ended up costing them a shot in the playoff this year because they had that early loss and they were fighting back to get into the top four this whole time. But, so, I mean, what if Oregon just played a smaller school? Like, what if they just played, you know, Elon in the first round or something and then beat them? So, I would argue that you're incentivized, it's, you're not decentivized to play these top teams anymore in the beginning of the year, and it could provide for an even more exciting early season in college football.
The other side of that as well would be that teams like Clemson, who we always say have a light regular season schedule in the ACC in terms of college football, wouldn't really be faced to have to face these good teams during the regular season because, I mean, at 13-0 this season, they got the 3 seed. So they're obviously fitting into the format of this playoffs without losing against these mediocre or slightly above average teams, nothing very good. In the regular season competition. So those teams like Clemson, and I mean, Clemson's the one that sticks out because they do play in the ACC and they dominate. So they're going to fit into that 8 seed almost every year, even with one, maybe even 2 losses. So that's something that I looked at. And then the other thing would be not expanding the format, but potentially voting on the top four after the bowl games. So play the bowl games like it used to be. You'd have to reformat it a little bit because the college football playoffs right now are bowl games. So you'd have to make those non-playoff games and play the bowl games and then vote on the top four to make sure that you essentially get the 4 best teams. It's not always going to happen, but it's more of a shot to get those 4 best teams or at least the 4 teams that are playing the best towards the end of the season. That's another idea to keep it 4 teams. But going back to the meaning of the regular season, I just think that if there's more room to get seeding, then that means that the games are less meaningful during the regular season. That really just goes for the top programs that are usually in that position to get playoff spots that will probably get them if they're expanded to 8 teams. But, I mean, you mentioned that it will make it more meaningful because there's more games and more opportunities to make the playoffs. But, I mean, if we expand it to eight teams, and we'd eventually expand it to 16, and then at what point, what value does the playoff have is kind of where my argument's at, because the regular season college football, as I mentioned earlier, is just so dramatic, and I mean, there's really no margin for error, maybe 1 loss throughout the regular season, and that's kind of been like the spirit ever since the playoff has come into account. There hasn't been a 3-loss team make it. There's been 1 or 2 2-loss teams. So that's just kind of my point, where the regular season is really the highlight of the college football season. Obviously, the playoffs are the most exciting, and that's where we get the champion. But the regular season is really eventful, and that's because there's no margin for error for any of these teams.
Well, I think Clemson's a good example. And like you said, 13-0 this year, they got into the 3 seed. And, I mean, if they just stuck with the same schedule where they don't play that tough competition out of the conference, and they just play the ACC, they'll get into the playoff every time. But like you said, if you expand it to 8 teams, it leaves for more margin for error, so they can take that risk and play a top team. Like, what if they played LSU the first or second game of the season for a number of years in a row? Like, that would be a really exciting way to start the college football season, but then the loser of that game isn't going to be out of the playoff because you have 8 teams. There's more room for error. So I think that's one of the bigger factors in it, and that could be one of the better parts of it. And then I just think overall, you're able to really see the true champion if you have 8 teams, because if you have 4, you know, what if you just match up well against these certain teams? You know, what if there's a team on the outside that had a few injuries or something, or for whatever reason something went wrong, but they're the best team? The more teams you add, and I'm not saying at having 16, 32 teams eventually is the way to go, but I think if you have 8, you're really able to truly see the true champion, because I think finding the 4 best teams is a tough thing to do, but finding the 8 best teams, it's probably more clear-cut at that point.
Yeah. I mean, a 3-round, 8 team playoff format would be a lot more interesting come playoff time, but I just see that as being kind of counterproductive in the terms of, if you can't get these top 4 teams like you were just talking about, I don't know if they're going to be able to really capture the top 8. I know it's easier to do in a sense, but also at the same time it's harder because you are expanding that. So then if the 9th and 10th team is really good, then are they better than the 8th team? I mean, there's I talked about it earlier, but there's always going to be room for controversy. The other thing is that some people have been saying that it opens up opportunities for people, like, I mean, you mentioned Memphis, but how well is Memphis going to match up against an LSU team? So if that's the 1-8 matchup, then LSU really isn't playing a game. I think that they would have won that game by 50, 60, 70. I mean, that wouldn't have been a very good game to watch. So that's kind of what we're opening up to if we were to expand it. Those kind of non, I mean, we have that a little bit in this format so far. We've seen blowouts in the 1-4 matchups previously. But that's just kind of the idea of if you bring in that, obviously you give a team like Memphis a shot. If you expand it, but if you bring in teams of that caliber that have overperformed for their conference and or within their conference and have really done great for the season, but aren't in those Power Five conferences, so don't get the attention, then I just feel like they would get squashed as soon as they play those really good teams that are competing for championships.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a good point, and I mean that's something that I was definitely thinking about when I was preparing and researching for this. And I mean, I think the biggest part of that is, like, we saw UCF a few years ago. They went undefeated and were calling themselves national champions. This is a way to get those teams that don't have as much recognition and don't play the best teams in the country to give them a chance to go up against these best teams in the country and see really how good they are. We'd be able to see if UCF were the true national champions. And then, but the thing is, like you said, Memphis probably would get squashed by LSU this year, so maybe 8 teams isn't the best, but maybe 6 teams is the right way to go. You give the first and second, the top 2 teams a bye. You have 3 play 6, 4 play 5, because I think usually that's where the debate is, between 3 or between 4, 5, and 6. Those teams are usually really close with each other. So if you have those teams battle to get into the top 4, then I think you might have a better playoff. So maybe 6 teams is the best, maybe 8 teams is the best, but I think overall just expanding it is the right move.
So this year, the number 5 seed when at the end of the voting was Georgia. And in the SEC championship, Georgia and LSU played each other, and LSU won 37-10 because they were clearly the much better team and had the much better game, at least in that game. So if there's a 8 or even 6 playoff format, Georgia falls into that 5 seed as a 2-loss team, and they would play, if it was a 8 seed format, then they'd play Oklahoma. So that game would be pretty interesting to watch. We'd see who was better out of Oklahoma and Georgia. But I don't think that Georgia deserves a playoff spot after getting blown out the week before. And if you eliminate, or if you expand the playoffs, then you eliminate the competition in that SEC playoff game, because it meant so much to Georgia and it meant so much to LSU, because if there's only 4 teams, the difference between a 1 seed and a 3 seed is so dramatic. So it takes a little bit of meaning out of those conference championship games. I do like the idea, because obviously more football is better for all of us as fans, but I just don't see the advantage, because I feel like that it would just take competition out of it during the regular season.
Yeah, and I think that's the biggest part of it, is how much are you devaluing the regular season? And I mean, you talked about it earlier, how it could be less meaningful, but I mean, there's arguments for it both ways. And I mean, I just think overall, the biggest part of this is that there's always controversy, it seems, between those last few teams in the playoff. So you want to try and figure out, A, the best way to get the best teams in the country to battle it out for the national championship, and B, just trying to figure out the best way to do that, whether it's 4 teams, 6 teams, 8 teams, and just the format for it. So I think it's been something that they've talked about ever since they created the playoff from the original BCS when they moved to 4 teams. They were always talking about it from there. Are we going to expand this? And it seems like every year they debate this, but then don't end up going through with it. So, I mean, maybe in a few years we'll see an expansion, and, I mean, I guess at that time, only time will tell whether it works or not.
Yeah, I mean, even though I'm on the no side of the debate, I would love to see an expansion, because, like I just mentioned, more football is better for all of the fans, and obviously we'd love to see the Oklahoma-Georgia games that this year's format would give us. In the coming years, see those the second-tier teams of those conferences play each other. So moving on, our next question is going to be a debate between the luxury tax and the salary cap. So the luxury tax is essentially a tax that needs to be paid if you go over a set amount by the league. It's seen most notably in the MLB. And then the salary cap is almost the opposite, where you can't go over that number. and that's seen in the NFL.
Yeah, so first, I mean, I'm on the luxury tax side, so I'm just going to run through the numbers real quick because it's pretty complicated when you, I mean, honestly, before this, I didn't really know how much it really costs for a team and how harsh the penalties are. So for the MLB, in the first season that you go over the luxury tax, so I believe this year it's $208 million, you pay 20% of what you go over. So if you go $10 million over, you pay $2 million. If you go over for the second straight season, you pay 30% of what you go over. For the third straight season, you pay 50% of what you go over. But then, if a club goes $20 to $40 million over, so if it's $210 million this year, they go over $230 million, then they're charged an additional 12% from what they're charged for the season fee. And then if a club goes over $40 million over, they're charged 42.5% for the first year, then 45% the following years added to the tax for the amount of years. So basically, to sum this all up, if a team goes over $40 million over the luxury tax for the first time, but it's their third year over the tax threshold, then they're going to owe 92.5% of that amount that they go over. So if they go $100 million over, then they're going to pay $92.5 million.
Which is on top of their salary.
Yeah, which is on top of the salary, which, I mean, that's something that owners don't want to do at all. And then for the NBA, it's even harsher where, I'm not going to run through all of them, but you're paying, if you go over $5 million, if you go up to $5 million over, it's $1.50. From $5 to $10 million, it's $1.75. So I'm not going to run through the rest of them, but it's even harsher in the NBA. So, I mean, I think that the best part about the luxury tax is that it is a harsh penalty. And, you know, with the salary cap, you don't have the option of going over, but in the NBA and the MLB specifically, you have the option of going over, but you have to pay a price. It's not like you can just spend as much money as you want. The owners have to make that decision if they want to do it or not. And we saw this year with the Boston Red Sox, how they wanted to get under the luxury tax because they didn't want to have to pay that fine that they've been paying the past few years. So they ended up trading away Mookie Betts, and that was that. So, and then in 2019, the teams that went over the luxury tax in the MLB were the Red Sox, the Cubs, and the Yankees. None of them won. So it's not like going over the luxury tax necessarily means you're going to win. So I don't think that's that much of a negative to it, where people say that you can just buy championships, because that's not the way it works. But then I think the biggest part about it is it allows for players to get paid what they actually deserve instead of teams offering less so that they can stay under the salary cap. So an example of this is Gerrit Cole. He got $324 million from the Yankees, where they wouldn't have been able to pay that if they wanted to stay under the luxury tax. But they made the sacrifice of having to pay the penalty, and they paid Gerrit Cole as well. So teams have to find that balance whether they want to or not, and I just think giving them the option is the best way to do it rather than just saying you can't go over this number.
So for me, the salary cap is more appealing, only because it really just sets up for a fair playing advantage in terms of spending and the cap and stuff like that. I like the idea of how the NFL sets a hard salary floor, which means that a team can't spend under a certain amount, which keeps teams from essentially tanking and not spending any money on their players to secure a higher pick or something of that sort. So there's only been 8 teams to ever exceed the luxury tax in the MLB ever. So these teams are the San Francisco Giants, the Boston Celtics, the Los Angeles Angels, the Detroit Tigers, Los Angeles Dodgers, New York Yankees, Chicago Cubs, and most recently, Washington Nationals. In recent baseball, those are the teams that are winning. I'm not saying that it definitely correlates to winning, because like Harrison just mentioned, the teams that as recently as 2015, the 3 teams that were paying or overpaying the luxury tax did not win a playoff series. So that's really significant as well, where it doesn't always amount to that, but it can. What I wanted to point out was the dynasties we've seen throughout the 1990s in baseball, most notably the New York Yankees and the Atlanta Braves. These teams are really able to build and sustain their dominance of the sport through the luxury tax and that idea. If there was a salary cap, they'd have to figure out a way to trade their players before their value was decreased and bring in younger players with smaller contracts, what we see the Patriots do in the NFL, and that's why they're so successful. So it opens up for more strategy, I mean, the smallest market in the NFL is Green Bay with the Packers. Obviously, there's no luxury tax in the NFL, so they don't have to worry about spending more or less than any of those other teams. But if there was a luxury tax, then Green Bay would be on the outs. I mean, a lot of other teams would be as well, but they would be on the outs in terms of spending and free agents and all of that sorts of stuff. So essentially, I like the idea that it gives the players their fair value. I hadn't previously thought about that. Because it does give an opportunity for those teams to pay for the players. And the other interesting point is that teams have to go below the salary, or once they reach below the luxury tax, it resets, which makes it a little bit more meaningful, because obviously if you want to just reset, like you just mentioned Mookie Betts, they wanted to reset it so that they can build up for the future and you're not constantly overpaying for a team that's not going to do that well.
Yeah, so, I mean, first you talked about the Yankees and the Braves in the 90s, and, I mean, yeah, the Yankees are a team that has historically spent a lot of money on their players, and, I mean, I talked about Gerrit Cole, they did it this year, but, I mean, their teams in the 90s, four of their best players were Andy Pettit, Jorge Posada, Derek Jeter, and Mariano Rivera. All four of them were still on rookie contracts at the time, so they still weren't getting paid a lot of money, and, yeah, they paid a few guys a lot, but they didn't really buy those championships as much as people probably think they did. In 2009, I would say they might have, because they signed, I think, four free agents that year. But the 90s, not so much. And I think the point I like that you made a lot is the NFL has that salary floor. And I think that's something that teams, or I think that that's something baseball should adopt, because you have teams like the Oakland Athletics, the Pittsburgh Pirates, where they're barely spending any money. I mean, I think compared to Gerrit Cole's entire salary this year, they're paying right around what he's getting paid for the entire team. So I think you need a salary floor, because there's teams that just aren't competitive. And like you said, that's how you prevent tanking. And so I think that's definitely a good idea. But we've seen success, though, with teams that don't go over the luxury tax. I mean, the Oakland A's last year were a wild card team. The movie Moneyball, that's one of my favorite movies. And for people that haven't seen it, it's about the Oakland A's in, I think, 2002, where they had a 30-something million-dollar payroll, and they make it all the way to the playoffs. So I think that for some teams, the luxury tax does, for the lower-market teams, it doesn't matter as much, because they almost treat it still as a salary cap, but it just acts as a way for the bigger-market teams to have a penalty if they want to go over that.
Yeah, I mean, that was my next point about the A's, where small-market teams in a luxury tax league can have success. I mean, it's a lot more rare, but it is possible, as we've seen through Moneyball, like you just mentioned. But another thing I wanted to mention is the NBA. Going back to the early 2010s or the late 2000s, we saw teams such as the Dallas Mavericks have sustained success. The Boston Celtics, the Los Angeles Lakers, all of these teams were over the luxury tax. I mean, it resulted in championships for these respective teams, and it's a way to keep your team together once you have those players in your building, and to keep them in your building without having to give up another piece of your team. So it is it's a good idea, and I like certain aspects of it, but if there was a salary cap, then you might have seen, there's Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, Rajon Rondo, and Ray Allen in Boston. I don't think the three of those, with an actual depth, with an actual roster behind them, would have been on the same team with a salary cap, or at least stayed on the same team for as long as they did, 3 or 4 years. So you'd see teams like that break up. You obviously wouldn't have the teams of Miami Heat with Chris Bosh, LeBron, and D. Wade. That just wouldn't be possible with a salary cap. That's why free agency is a lot more dominant in the NBA, and it is it does make headlines and it is flashy, but in terms of competition and keeping it on a fair playing level so that those small market teams such as Milwaukee, I mean, obviously they have Giannis right now, but before that they've just struggled to compete because you have to bring in those free agents. They hit a home run and they drafted a free agent, but they would never be able to sign a Giannis caliber player on the open market because of that luxury tax, and teams willing to spend over that, and they just don't have the resources to do so.
Well, I think the bigger problem is the NBA is the luxury tax is probably too low, because with how these NBA player contracts are rising with these max contracts, like I think Giannis can make $256 million on his next contract over the course of 4 or 5 years, whatever it is. So I think they need to raise it, because I think that's the bigger issue, where a team like the Bucks, are they going to be able to have the money to spend on Giannis plus have a team around him with Chris Middleton and all these other guys? I don't think they are, because if they're paying him that much money, they're not going to want to spend on that luxury tax. So I think that's a bigger issue in the NBA. And then, I mean, overall, there's pros and cons to each. And, I mean, the salary cap probably is better, honestly. But I think the luxury tax isn't as bad as people make it seem. It just, people do think it buys championships. And I think there are times when it does, but it's not as bad as it is.
Yeah, and there's definitely a stigma around the luxury tax, only because, like you just mentioned, there have been those teams. Not every team that's over the luxury tax is buying championships, because you obviously have to have a great team. You can't just pay money, and, I mean, it's got to work out in your favor. And obviously there is examples of the luxury tax not working out. The Portland Trailblazers have been over the luxury tax. They're not over it currently, but in the past, from 2016 until 2018, they were over the luxury tax, and they didn't win a single playoff series. So that's really kind of significant, because although they are spending and overspending over the luxury tax, it's not doesn't equate to success in the playoffs. So that's another point as well, where, I mean, the salary cap is better in terms of keeping the competition level the same, but the luxury tax doesn't always result, or going over the luxury tax doesn't always result in winning or championships or anything like that, because there are teams, I mean, there's teams on both ends. We mentioned the A's that overachieve for their salary, and there's teams like the Trailblazers that underachieve for what they're paying their players. So there, like you just mentioned, Harrison, there are sides to each, and it is really interesting to look at.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, where there are teams that go over the luxury tax but then don't do as well. I mean, the Cubs are a team that was over the luxury tax last year. They didn't even make the playoffs. So, I mean, I think that's where teams have to decide, where are they spending the right money if they're going to go over the luxury tax. And I think that's something that, as we're seeing more and more teams go over the luxury tax, they're trying to be smart about it. And then when they realize that they don't have the right players in place, that's when they try and go under and rebuild.
Yeah, and another point I wanted to mention was the ability to sustain winning. In the NFL, it's really hard to do unless you have a great quarterback and a great coach. We've seen that be the formula, because, I mean, that's really the two big pieces you need. But to be able to sustain a full, deep roster is really hard. We've seen the Patriots do it, and most recently, I mean, not in the past few seasons, but we've seen Seattle be successful with their defense. I mean, obviously, once those guys got a little older, it wasn't as successful. But that's the other team that comes to mind, where you have to get those guys into your building when they're younger with a smaller contract, all of that, and be able to get rid of them either trade or free agency when they're past their value, and you're going to have to overpay because you can't go over that luxury tax. There's not that security where, oh, we need this one, we need one more guy and we're going to be good. We can't just go out and sign him. We need to cut somebody else to secure that money to pay him. So I don't think a team like the Patriots would have that sort of dominance if the NFL had a luxury tax, because you can have I'm just going to say the Los Angeles Chargers go out and spend a bunch of money on free agents just because they're in this big market in Los Angeles, and go over that luxury tax and win two Super Bowls in a row because they have the top 5 or 6 free agents from the past 3 classes. I mean, that just negates the Patriots and all of their excellence. So that's just my point, is that not only just the fair playing field, but just being able to sustain success without going over that luxury tax and in a sustained budget.
Yeah, and so speaking of the NFL, we're going to move on to our next question. So we all saw the 49ers this year go from a 4-win team and having the number 2 overall pick to going all the way to the Super Bowl and ending up losing to the Chiefs. So we wanted to ask ourselves which teams we both thought would be next year's 49ers. So we chose from either a 4, 5, or 6 win team from the NFL this season. So, Jake, you want to start?
Yeah, so my team is the Los Angeles Chargers. They were 5-11 last year, 4th in the AFC West, which is last place. Phillip Rivers is no longer on the team, so that's mainly the reason why I'm picking this team. Last year, they had 8 losses by 1 score or less, and 10 losses by 2 scores or less, so that's 10 points, or 14 points. So that's, I mean, they had 11 losses, so if 10 of them are within 10 points, then that's really meaningful. You need just a few more pieces to get you over the hump in each and every one of those games. They also had a negative 17 turnover differential, and Phillip Rivers was second in the league in interceptions, so that just doesn't help you. Their defense was a lot better than people thought, or at least spoke about last season, and they were sixth in yards per game. And I just think this team has a lot going for it. They've been injured the past few years, and when they have reached the playoffs, not as much recently, but earlier in Phillip Rivers' career, they've only lost to New England. So, I mean, a lot of teams have only lost to New England. That's lightly said. but now that they're, I mean, at least it seems like it, fading out of the division, if they can get a quarterback, and I don't know who that is, maybe Teddy Bridgewater or maybe somebody in the draft, then they can. I think they can be really successful in the next few years, because the only thing that they've been missing is health and elite quarterback play. Phillip Rivers has been a little close in terms of elite, but he just too many interceptions, a little bit too many fumbles, and just some errant throws that if you get a guy in there that can get it done and play the right way and not turn the ball over, then I think they can flip this around and have a similar season that the 49ers had.
Yeah, so I like the Chargers a lot. They were one of the two teams I was debating between, and the team that I ended up choosing was the Arizona Cardinals, and the main reason for that is both Kyler Murray and Cliff Kingsbury improved a lot over the course of the year. It was a little rough at first, but, I mean, Cliff Kingsbury really improved the offense and made some adjustments going from the college game to the NFL throughout the season, and Kyler Murray adjusted as well, and I'm expecting both of them to do a lot better in year two. Kyler, speaking of his improvement over the year, he had 13 touchdowns in the second half of the season after just 7 in the first half, so that's a lot better. And then, I mean, we've seen second-year quarterbacks make the big jump to help lead their team. And, I mean, an obvious example is Lamar Jackson this year. He went from, you know, an average quarterback who was an elite runner to a great quarterback, and he ended up winning the MVP this year. And I'm not saying Kyler Murray is going to win the MVP next year, but I wouldn't be surprised if he takes a big jump into that upper echelon, maybe top 10 to 12 quarterbacks in the league. And I mean, I think that there are definitely a lot of moves that this team needs to make. I think that they need to get another receiver in there, because right now I don't think they have a true number one. They'll probably, I don't know if they re-signed Fitzgerald already, but he'll be back. Christian Kirk is going to be back. And then outside of that, they don't really have any stud receivers. They don't have a great tight end. So definitely improve the weapons. And then on defense, they got to improve a lot, but they have a decent amount of cap space, but they also have a high draft pick in the first round to get a game changer there. So, I mean, I think overall that they have a young team, just like the 49ers did, that will be able to take a leap next year to maybe get to, not, I'm not saying the Super Bowl, but they can definitely compete for a division, maybe get, I'd say, 10, 11 wins is not out of the realm of possibility for next year.
Yeah, I liked your point about the cap space, because the Cardinals have the 14th most cap space and the Chargers have the 13th. So both of these teams are, I mean, completely prepared for spending. And to your point, I think the Chargers need to do a little bit of spending or address their issues in the draft as well. I mean, they definitely need to revamp their offensive line, whether that's via free agency or trade. I mean, free agency or the draft, we'll see. The draft takes a little bit longer in terms of linemen to develop, and it might take a year or two for them to fully initiate that offensive line help. And then they also need, I don't think they need any weapons on offense. They have Austin Eckler, who'll be back, Mike Evans. They have Keenan Allen and a few other pretty good receivers on the outside. Hunter Henry, they should look to re-sign, but I don't know if he'll be able to find the right value in Los Angeles. And they have to revamp their defense a little bit too, just the secondary in specific, because they aren't getting those turnovers they need, especially when your quarterback's giving the ball away. I don't think they'll have nearly as many turnovers on offense next year, unless there's a rookie quarterback, but that's just setting you up for the future. But it really depends on what they do at quarterback. The Cardinals are a safer pick, because I do agree Kyler Murray definitely should make that jump from the first year to the second year. Just like, I mean, you mentioned Lamar Jackson, but Patrick Mahomes, he sat out his first year, but he did make that jump in terms of first and second year production-wise. So it really depends on who the Chargers get in their quarterback room. Right now they only have Tyrod Taylor, who was not my favorite NFL quarterback. Let's just say that. I mean, he's a good backup, but he's not going to get you to a 49er-level season that they just had last year. So it really depends on the defense. I like Joey Bosa and Melvin Ingram at the defensive line. Obviously, the 49ers just showed that the defensive line is really important. Even though a great quarterback can neutralize that in the Super Bowl, I mean, it's really important in getting there, having that great defensive line play. So I feel like they're set up for success on the defensive side of the ball, just a little bit more needed there. And it just really depends on that quarterback, because I feel like a Teddy Bridgewater or, I mean, just like game managers that could come in there, not really turn the ball over, run the ball, get it where it needs to go, and not turn the ball over is what they need, because Phil Rivers seemed to do a little bit too much. He was always up there in yards per game and yards per season, but he just was always up there in interceptions as well. So protecting the ball is important, and putting the ball in the end zone is equally as important.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with everything you said. I think that, you know, the quarterback position is definitely going to be interesting, whether at six they potentially trade up for a quarterback. They can move up to number three and take Tua. They could take Justin Herbert. So I think that'll be an interesting point. And I think just looking back at the Cardinals too, just like the Chargers, they need to improve that offensive line. They just re-signed DJ Humphries to a big contract this week. I like that move a lot. But then outside of that, there's not a ton of talent there. So I wouldn't be surprised if with that number seven or number eight overall pick, they take an offensive lineman. And then, I mean, I talked about the receiver position earlier, where this is one of the, this is a historically great wide receiver draft class, where they can get potentially late first, early second round guys in the third and fourth round. So they can get some top guys there. And then on this team's defense, they have a lot of good young players. They have Buda Baker, who was up there in the NFL in terms of tackles last year. Jordan Hicks was top notch. Chandler Jones is still one of the best defensive linemen in terms of getting to the quarterback in the NFL today. Patrick Peterson is a top quarterback or cornerback, and he missed the first six games last year with suspension, so they'll hopefully get a whole season out of him. And then Byron Murphy Jr. at safety is also another, or sorry, cornerback is also another good player. So they have young talent on this team and on this defense. Now it's going to be about developing that talent as the years come and finding the right free agents and veterans that can fit into this defense and this team overall to, you know, help build a better Arizona Cardinals future.
Yeah, I really like both of our picks here. I mean, I think both are set up for that jump of success in next season. And, I mean, overall, just the Chargers, for me, wrapping up my point, would be their, I mean, what stands out to me is their eight losses by one score or less. So if they can really focus in on finishing out these games strong and keeping the ball, I mean, I've talked about it a lot, but that ball security has really hurt them in the past 3 or 4 years with Philip Rivers aging a little bit, and these receivers were a little bit younger, so there's drops in that equation as well. So I think that they're a little bit more, or they're a little bit older than the Cardinals, but I think they're still poised for a run because they do have a little bit of youth on that roster, and the players that are a little bit older aren't too old, if that makes sense, because they've been in this position for a few years, but I feel like that this quarterback change needed to happen, and it finally has. So I think that they'll have a pretty good year next year. It's just whether or not they have that quarterback of the future or the quarterback of now come week one.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think these are two teams that are definitely set up well in the future, and we'll be able to see next year how much they improve. So we're going to move on to our final debate question, and we've been talking about this the last few weeks, the NBA title favorite. And so for me, I'm going to go with the Clippers. And I mean, the first reason that I have down is Kawhi Leonard. I just think what we saw last year in the playoffs, him basically dethroning the entire Golden State Warriors championship dynasty, was unbelievable. He took over games, hit that big shot against the Sixers. And then we've always heard a debate about Paul George, whether it was in OKC, whether it was in Indiana. Can he be the best player on a championship team? Well, now he doesn't have to be. He's a great number two option on a championship team, and so I think that's an added bonus. They got Marcus Morris, which we talked about, the trade deadline was an awesome move for them. One, because they were able to get him, but two, keep him away from the Lakers. He's a great scorer, and he has a lot of playoff experience. Lou Williams is another great veteran scorer with playoff experience. Patrick Beverley, tremendous defender, fearless leader. And then overall, this team defensively is tremendous. We said Beverley, they have Leonard, they have Paul George, and Montrezl Harrell is another big guy down low that's a great defender. And then lastly, top five scoring team and top five rebounding team. So this team just does everything really well. They've had a little bit of a slide lately, but I mean, I don't think that'll affect them. And I still, right now for me, they are definitely the finals favorites.
So going off your first point, Kawhi Leonard didn't dethrone the Warriors. Injuries did. So
okay.
If Klay Thompson and Kevin Durant are playing for that team and fully healthy, I think that, I mean, that would have changed a lot in terms of the NBA and free agency and everything, but the Raptors wouldn't have been champions. Obviously, he had a great playoffs and everything, but for me, the finals favorite right now is the Los Angeles Lakers, the other team in that building. Offensively and statistically, Paul George is having his worst year since 2012. I know he has never played on a team like this with that depth and all the playmakers around them, but as Kendrick Perkins said the other day, I mean, there's only one basketball. They've just brought in Reggie Jackson. They traded for Marcus Morris. I mean, there's only one basketball on this team, and there's so much, not only offensive, but defensive firepower. And it works both ways because obviously they have all these players that can play, but it's you can only have five out there when I'm just going to assume that these two teams are playing in the Western Conference Finals. So when you're in the Western Conference Finals, Game 7, your depth doesn't matter. It's about a little bit throughout the game, but not in the final 4 or 5 minutes where you need five guys out there that can win you the game. And for me, I just think that those five on the Lakers are much better than the five for the Clippers. I mean, you look at
really?
Anthony Davis, Defensive Player of the Year candidate right now.
Okay.
He is playing one of his best seasons statistically, and he's just, I mean, he's Anthony Davis. He's one of the best players in the world. And then LeBron James, he's playing the lowest minutes per game of his career, which might seem like that's odd because he's playing so much, so many minutes, but it is the lowest of his career, so we can't be concerned about his sustainability. Earlier when we were talking about this, I did have the Clippers, and that's because these two are neck and neck in terms of who's the favorite.
Yeah.
But I was kind of just concerned about LeBron's health and will he be able to sustain this? He's playing almost 36 minutes per game. That's a lot. And then I looked back at historically, and it's not a lot. I mean, that's what LeBron does. He plays a lot in the regular season, and he performs in the playoffs. So I'm not really concerned, even though it is year 17. The only reason that LeBron wouldn't go to the finals this year, in my opinion, would be health. If for some reason he gets injured, obviously my pick would be the Clippers. Another point that I had is that the last time that LeBron James wasn't in the playoff last year because of injury, and the team was pretty bad. I mean, those guys are all gone now, so you could tell how that worked out. But when healthy, he's made 8 straight finals. I know he's older now and he's aged and the West is really competitive and, yeah, the Clippers are pretty good. But I'm not going to doubt LeBron in the playoffs. I mean, he hasn't lost a playoff series before the finals in 9, coming on 10 seasons, which is just so meaningful. I mean, he's sustained his dominance throughout the NBA. This could be the year that, I mean, Kawhi Leonard and the Clippers could change that narrative and dethrone him officially. But I don't see that happening. I mean, my pick is it's got to be LeBron.
Okay. That's a lot of points there. I think, first, I mean, you talk about Paul George. Yeah, it's been his worst statistical season, but I think that that's just because he's been coming on and off of injuries. And, I mean, started the season coming off of his shoulder surgery. He's had nagging injuries elsewhere. So I think once he starts to get in a groove, he'll be fine. But, I mean, I think that the Clippers starting five is better than the Lakers starting five. I mean, I would take Harrell, Leonard, George, Beverly, and Lou Williams over Davis, LeBron, who is it, Caldwell Pope?
You mentioned them having a better starting five than the Lakers. Mm-hmm. That would be the Clippers. And so for me, the starting five of LeBron, Anthony Davis, you either have JaVale McGee or Dwight Howard. I would prefer Dwight Howard, but JaVale has been playing a lot more minutes as of late. And then you have Danny Green and Kyle Kuzma. Kyle Kuzma is yet to be seen whether or not he can perform in the playoffs. As a third scoring option, he's phenomenal. If he's your first scoring option, your team's not very good. But if he's your third scoring option, that's pretty good. Who's going to guard Anthony Davis? Montrezl Harrell can try, but I don't know how well that's going to go for him. the other point is that the Clippers have beaten the Lakers twice this season, one on Christmas and one on the very first game of the season. And I just don't know if that matters. Only because we've seen LeBron lose to the Warriors in, I believe it was 2017, that he won the finals. He lost to them once during the regular season. They only played once. So, I mean, that just doesn't... It's all about that final Western Conference Finals series. And I know Kawhi has been great in the past offseason and in the past postseason and in previous postseasons with the Spurs, but I can't doubt LeBron when it comes down to... I mean, the only person that's beat LeBron is Kevin Durant, Steph Curry, the Hampton Five of Klay Thompson, Draymond, and that's the greatest five to ever step on the court together. So, obviously, that might have been the end of LeBron's prime, year 13 to 16. They kind of ruined that in terms of LeBron's playoff production. But Paul George, he showed up a little bit with the Pacers in the playoffs, but in Oklahoma City, I think they won one playoff game or one playoff series in 2 years. He just kind of underperformed. Obviously, Russell Westbrook is a lot less of a player than Kawhi Leonard. I'm not taking anything away from him, but Kawhi's just that good. So we'll see how he plays next to Kawhi Leonard. But for me, I mean, this Western Conference Finals is going to be great. Both teams are playing home and away games both times, so it doesn't matter that the Lakers have a higher seeding. Which is going to be awesome because they don't have to travel. They can just stay in LA. So it's going to be really interesting to watch either way. But the way that LeBron has aged this year, in terms of being able to pass the ball, if he was averaging 10 rebounds, then he would have a triple double average. He's only averaging 7.5 rebounds, but the fact that he's averaging almost 11 assists per game is pretty darn good. So just his growth in terms of his assist and his passing. And still having that elite ability to score the ball and keep the defense guessing is just where my head's at in terms of taking LeBron and having my confidence in him.
I mean, yeah, I think it's obviously tough to pick against LeBron, and you brought up a good point where he hasn't not made it to the finals when he's made the playoffs in 8 years. So, yeah, that's something to consider. But I just think he hasn't had that great competition in the East besides, like, he won't he'll have a much harder time getting to the finals this year than he did have in those 8 years. And I mean, so I think even if you treat this like a like you can say this is equal to what his finals would have been back when he was in the East. So I think I just think from a Clippers point of view, if you don't have Paul George take the final shot, you don't have Kawhi Leonard because for whatever reason they're locked up, I think they have two other guys that I can confidently say can take that final shot. On the Lakers, I don't know
Lou
if I
Williams
do.
And who else?
And Marcus Morris. Shoots over 40% from 3-point. I would trust him to make it.
I mean, okay,
he's made
so
big shots
Danny
in the
Green
past.
With championship
experience. I trust him.
Championship experience, he can knock down a big shot. Obviously, LeBron and AD can knock down. And, I mean...
I don't trust Kuzma enough, honestly.
No, I wasn't even going to go into Kuzma. But outside of those three, there's not elite... I wouldn't say... I guess elite closing, you could say. But... How much more do you need outside of LeBron James in terms of closing?
But I think you can say the same thing about Kawhi Leonard because of just what we saw last year, where he's just in the he did everything he wanted to do last year.
Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid and even Giannis are on a, I don't want to say far, but on an inferior level than LeBron James.
Yeah.
Even Giannis, as great as he's been in the past two seasons, is not as good as LeBron James.
I agree.
Even in year 17.
Yeah.
So the fact that Kawhi cakewalked through the East, besides that dramatic ending in Philly, he basically just cakewalked through the East last season.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that speaks on the fact that he's going to beat LeBron, because LeBron did the same thing.
Well, I think even in the finals, even though Kevin Durant didn't play, besides those few minutes, and then he ended up getting hurt, that was still a 72-win team. The Klay, Draymond, Steph,
Klay missed Game 3 and Game 7.
Of?
The finals.
He tore his ACL Game 6. He missed Game 3, too?
Yes, he missed Game 3 before.
All right, well, besides that...
I mean, that's a lot of absences.
I know, but still, I think... I still think he just dominated in that series. There was nobody even close to on his level. And I'm not saying he's on LeBron's level, but I'm saying he can carry a team like LeBron, and And outside of LeBron, I would take him over anyone in the NBA in the playoffs.
Yeah, outside of LeBron, but that's why I'm taking LeBron.
But I think it's I think it's really close where where I take the Clippers over him too.
Yeah, and another point, obviously you're going to have a rebuttal because the Clippers do play defense too, but the Lakers have the highest defensive rating in the fourth quarter this year.
Good for them.
The second lowest in the entire league in like any quarter in the entire game, and well, actually that point doesn't matter because they play in the same stadium. They've tied most road wins, but I guess if they're playing in the Coliseum, it's not going to matter. The other thing would be the seeding, because the Clippers, I'm not saying they're going to lose before the Western Conference Finals, but they're going to have a harder time getting there. So although they're even if they're the 3 seed or the 2 seed, they're going to beat those teams that are ranked higher than whoever the 2 seed happens to be, because I think they are the best or the second best team in the West. But it's just about that process of getting there. We mentioned earlier that Kawhi cakewalked through the East and kind of had a load management of sort until he got to the...
Yeah.
I mean, that Bucks series was 5 or 6 games. It wasn't very long.
I think it was 6.
Yeah, barely 6.
Yeah.
So the fact that he's going to have to play those 6, maybe 7-game series in the first and second round could take a toll. I don't know how much it would be, but it could take a little bit of a toll on them. And it's going to be a tougher playoff series or playoffs than at least Kawhi had last year.
Yeah, and I mean, just to wrap this up, I definitely agree with that. Where honestly, right now, I'm a little worried about them because right now they're not playing very well. They lost to the Kings, and I mean, they dominated the Grizzlies last night, but they have not looked great lately. And I'm worried that they're going to slip in the standings a little bit. I think they'll figure it out by the playoffs, but I'm worried that what if they fall to the 4 seed, they potentially have to face the Lakers in the semifinals.
Yeah, exactly.
That would, I mean,
that's not good for either of them.
That's not good for either of them. And I mean, then you have a team, then they probably play either the Rockets or the Nuggets, I'm assuming, in the Western Conference Finals. And I don't think that's what people want.
And the other point, obviously LeBron is a very animated player on the court. And so we don't really feed into too much of his emotions on the floor, because he's always emotional. He's always flailing his arms at either the officials or the other team or his team. But Kawhi Leonard isn't like that. We've seen him be frustrated and throw his arms up in the air at his teammates. He's making a pass through the middle and his teammate runs to the corner instead of to the basket for a layup. So just frustrations like that obviously comes with the chemistry and playing together. And I think they will figure it out by the playoffs. But to your point, if they drop in the standings a little bit, that could be very problematic for the Clippers, because the Lakers are in that spot. They have a 5-game lead right now, and I don't think that they're going to lose that top seed. That's kind of been LeBron's thing, is just get me that top seed and I'll stay up there and then I'll just run through the playoffs. Obviously, he did it in a much better Eastern Conference for the majority of his career, but this is just going to, I mean, either way, whoever wins, it's going to be super entertaining for us as fans. Mm-hmm. I think it'll be the Eastern Conference Finals, unless, like you said, they drop to the 4 seed and they have to play them before that. But yeah, I can't really bet against LeBron, partly because you bet on the Clippers first, but I can't really bet against LeBron. the only concern that I have with my pick for the NBA Finals favorite would be the fact that LeBron is in his 17th year.
Yeah.
If he's in any other year of his career, we're not having this debate. Obviously, LeBron's going to win the Finals. But it's just that age concern and how much of that production can he keep up come the final 4 possessions of Game 7.
Yeah, exactly. So now we're going to transition over to the NFL. So basically what we're going to do, we're going to pick 1 quarterback, 1 running back, 2 receivers, a tight end, a defensive lineman, a linebacker, and 1 defensive back, and basically just players that we want for the future. And so we're going to alternate picks and do kind of like a snake draft. And we both agreed before this that neither of us are going to take Patrick Mahomes, because he'd obviously be the quarterback of the future that we want. So I'll take out my coin and do a little coin flip for the first overall pick, called in the air.
Heads.
All right, it's tails. So I get the first pick. So let's see. At quarterback, I'm going to go with Deshaun Watson as my quarterback.
Hmm.
He's 24 years old. He's been in the league for 3 years. He had 3,800 passing yards last year, 26 touchdowns to go along with 7 rushing touchdowns. Only 1 playoff win in his career, and that came this year against the Bills. But I mean, personally, from what I've seen, I think he's the best young quarterback in this league outside of Patrick Mahomes, obviously. And I mean, he just has that knack that we've seen in college where he doesn't lose. He has the ability that whenever your team is down, you feel confident that he is going to lead that drive to win the game. In his career, he has 8 fourth quarter comebacks already and 10 game winning drives in just 3 seasons, really 2.5, because he missed half of his first year due to an injury. He has an exceptional arm. He's a great runner, and he's also a great leader and just a quarterback that players want to play for and want to win for. So I think that he'll be a great quarterback in this league for a long time, and that'll be my first overall pick.
Yeah, I really like that pick. Obviously, from the Clemson days, you see his competitiveness and just will to win. But for me, Russell Wilson is my quarterback. Just that playoff experience. He won with, obviously, he had a really elite defense, but those weapons on offense were not up to par in terms of what we've seen. Like Patrick Mahomes, his weapons this year in the playoffs and having that success was a lot greater than what Russell Wilson had to work with when he had his playoff success. So I feel like if you were to have even a mediocre defense, we saw this year they were below average and they won a bunch of games, made it to the playoffs. So it's just about getting him a defense, a little bit of a running game, and then he could do the rest by himself. This year he was third in MVP voting, just showing that, I mean, he's only 31 years old, and so just, you mentioned Deshaun Watson's ability to run. I feel like Russell Wilson has the same ability. It's pretty much comparable. He's just been great ever since he came into Seattle. I mentioned the previous playoff success, and now he's had to kind of revamp his career and focus more on the offensive side of the ball now that Seattle doesn't have that dominant defense. And I think that just made him a better pocket passer. Just he knows the offense better. He knows the defense better. And so I just think he's a really smart quarterback. He can put the ball where you need to put it, and he makes great decisions, and he's just perfect prototypical quarterback if he was 4 inches taller.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with all of that. The only reason I didn't take him, like you said, because of his age, just because he's on the wrong side of 30. But, I mean, I don't think he's still in the middle of his prime. And like you said, as they haven't had that great defense that they had in the beginning of part of his career, he's really elevated himself to be that top-tier elite quarterback. And, I mean, we saw him almost will his team back against the Packers this year in Green Bay. And then there were two other guys I was sort of considering, just Lamar Jackson and Kyler Murray. Kyler, just because he's so young in his second season, I think he's going to be a star. And then Lamar, obviously, winning MVP this year. But he just doesn't have the arm that I would have wanted in my quarterback.
Yeah, and, I mean, obviously, Patrick Mahomes is the obvious pick. But you mentioned Lamar Jackson. We touched on a little bit earlier in the podcast. I mean, he's a running back that has elite passing skills. It's insane. Mm-hmm. I mean, that hasn't really been seen in the NFL. I just like Russell Wilson more. Only because of his playoff experience, and he's shown that he can deliver in when it needs to be, and just he's established, I guess. Even though he is 31, he's still in his prime, and you've seen quarterbacks play till they're well into their 40s. So I think he has plenty left in the tank. So moving on to running back, my running back pick would be Saquon Barkley. He is not only the best running back prospect, but he's turning into one of the best running backs that we've seen in this league. He obviously has played on a below-average team, and that really relates to his quarterback play outside of this season. He's had Eli Manning, who at the back end of his career couldn't get too much done. This past season, he had over 1,000 receiving yards, 6 touchdowns, and almost 5 yards per carry, which is just awesome. I mean, if you can hand the ball off to your running back and you get half of the yards to go on first down, and then you have a 2nd and 5, it opens up your playbook by double, and you can run some of the stuff that you wouldn't have with a 2nd and 7 or a 2nd and 8 if you're behind those chains. It's only his second year, so he's really young. He did miss 3 games for injuries this year, but that's nothing to be concerned about. But, I mean, he had a down year from last year. With his rookie year, he had 1,300 yards and 11 touchdouns. And 5 average again. So he's been really good in the first 2 years, and I think that of the running back pool, he has the brightest future.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. That would have been my pick if I had the first pick here. So I'm going to go with Christian McCaffrey, still just 23 years old. He had the first ever 1,000-yard season where he had over 1,000 rushing yards and over 1,000 receiving yards. He had 15 rushing touchdowns And then he also had 116 catches and 4 receiving touchdowns, and then 1,387 rushing yards. And, I mean, we saw this year that he can really carry an entire offense. He seems like he's always open out of the backfield. He can always make guys miss. He actually had 1,019 yards after the catch. So, and that's more, and he only had 1,005 receiving yards. So that basically means a lot of the time he was just getting the ball behind the line of scrimmage and running from there, which is also tremendous. And then, I mean, him and Deshaun Watson can just run a deadly RPO option game on my team. So I'm pretty pleased with McCaffrey right now.
Yeah, and some of the other picks would be Derrick Henry. I mean, that would have been my pick if he was a little bit older. I guess Tennessee didn't figure out how to use him until he got to that age. And then Ezekiel Elliott. I came really close to picking Dalvin Cook. He's one of my personal favorite running backs just because that motor and that the legs just always seem to be moving. And he really has – I mean, you talked about McCaffrey's catching ability. Cook's not on that level in terms of catching, but he's definitely getting there in terms of the higher tier of running backs. So, yeah, those are the running backs. And, I mean, I like your pick. Too, because he's obviously such a bright star in this game. You're up for wide receiver.
Yeah, so for wide receiver, I'm going to take Michael Thomas. I mean, he had probably a top 3 to 5 best wide receiver season in NFL history. He broke the NFL record for receptions in a year with 149, and that obviously led the league. He led the league with 1,725 yards. He also had 9 touchdowns. He had an 80.5% catch percentage, which is just all passes targeted his way, which was the best among wide receivers. And he only had 6 drops on 185 targets. And those 185 targets also led the league. And, I mean, he did this without Drew Brees for 6 games, which is also remarkable. He's probably the best wide receiver in the NFL right now, in my opinion, and many others. He's still young enough, just 26 years old, that he'll be a wide receiver one for a number of years. And, I mean, he'll elevate any offense you put him on right away. He'll draw the double team and still be able to get himself open. He has tremendous hands and an incredible – he does an incredible job of creating separation, and that's how you get open on double teams. And, I mean, he's 6'3", so obviously a big receiver, and then dominant in the red zone. He had 12 red zone touchdowns last year, which also led the league, so – he's just a threat all over the field, and he's just a guy that you can build your offense around again.
Okay. For me, the pick would be DeAndre Hopkins. Last season, he had 1,165 receiving yards, 7 touchdowns, and over 100 catches. And in terms of production, I mean, that's, besides 2016 where he was injured for a few games, that's down in terms of his average production. So it's just he's always open, just like you talked about with Michael Thomas. That catch radius is just ungodly. I mean, you throw him the ball and mm-hmm. not expect him to catch it, and he comes up with the ball. And, I mean, I would argue that your quarterback wouldn't be nearly the quarterback without this guy right here. Obviously, the wide receiver production only matters so much in terms of quarterback play, but it is a factor. He catches, I mean, this is his second straight year with over 100 catches. He missed it by 4 the year before that, injured, and then he had 100 straight catches. So he would have had 5 straight years, barring injury, that he had 100 catches on the season. Another Clemson alum, so he's got that winning mentality where they don't lose football games regular season. They lose sometimes in the playoffs, but not often, so... I really like this pick. Obviously, Michael Thomas is a little bit better, but I feel like he has the future, too.
Yeah. I mean, Hopkins, obviously a great receiver, and, I mean, he probably would have been my pick if it wasn't for Michael Thomas. So, who was your wide receiver, too?
So, I went a little off par, in a sense, with Chris Godwin.
I wanted him.
He's only 23 years old, and that's why I picked him. 86 catches last year, 1,300 yards, 9 touchdowns. He was 3rd in the NFL in yards. And he's out of Penn State. He's a really fast receiver, but he's also tall. He's only 6'1". So that's relatively small for a wide receiver, but it's not too small at all. he's just really played well. I don't know if that's because of Mike Evans being on either side. That'll be something to look at in the coming years. But I just think that he has really great production. And out of the wide receiver pool right now in the rest of the NFL, I think that he has one of the top, if not the most potential left in him. He was only picked in 2017, so it is only his third year in the NFL. And at 23, I mean, there's so much room for growth. Some of these guys are still in their prime, and they're reaching the end of their 30s. So if he has 7 or 6 years left in his prime, then that's a pretty good pick.
Yeah, I think that's a great pick. That was who I was going to go with because I did not expect you to end up taking him. And, yeah, I mean, I agree. He's young still. He's going to be a star in this league. He had a breakout year last year. But with my second wide receiver, I'm going to take Davante Adams from the Packers. He's still just 27 years old. And in only 11 games last year, he still had 83 receptions, almost 1,000 yards. He fell just 3 short and 5 touchdowns. But in 2018, which was his true breakout year, he had 111 catches, 1,386 yards, 13 touchdowns, and only 5 drops on 127 targets. He's a guy that, on any level of the field, can make a play. You can throw it to him deep, he'll do it. Throw it on a slant route, throw it behind the line of scrimmage on a screen, he'll make guys miss. He's dominant in the red zone. He had 12 red zone touchdowns back in 2018, which is how many Michael Thomas had this year in 2019. He has terrific footwork. He gets an outstanding release every time, and he can run the entire route tree. Whatever you ask him to run, he will do it. And he's been talked about by all his teammates and coaches as a tremendous leader vocally, and you know they have a lot of young receivers on the Packers, and he's been a great mentor to them. And I mean that's big. And to have a wide receiver that can be a huge leader like that, that's something you want, to have an extra set of an extra mouth that can really talk to the young guys on the offense, especially that's not only the quarterback. So that's the main reason I went with him. I was also considering taking Odell Beckham Jr., Amari Cooper, and then Julio Jones. And Julio probably would have been my pick, but at 31 years old, he's probably past his prime and on his way down in his career. But he's still a star receiver.
Yeah, Amari Cooper was going to be my pick if I didn't take Chris Godwin. I mean, at 25, he's only got the future ahead of him, and he's played some of his best football in Dallas. So a lot of great wide receivers. I mean, we only picked 4, but there's a lot of great talent out there.
Yeah.
So moving on to tight end.
Yeah, so my tight end pick is going to be Travis Kelce. He's out of Cincinnati, 7 years in the league, and obviously on the Chiefs right now. He's 30 years old, but, I mean, he's still well into his prime and still has no sign of slowing down. He has 97 catches on 130 targets with 1,229 yards last season, and those all three were the most among tight ends. And he also had 5 touchdowns, which was 7th most among tight ends, but, I mean, with the other weapons the Chiefs have, you can't really complain about that. He's been the best receiving tight end in the league for a number of years now. He's huge. He's 6'5", 260, and he has that rare combination of size, skill, speed, and athleticism, and that just makes him so tough to guard. And, I mean, here's a quote from the 49ers tight ends coach just talking about Kelce. He said, "Some guys get open because they're great route runners. Some guys get open because they're big or whatever. He's a little bit of a combination of that. He has a great feel for setting guys up and then putting his foot in the ground and exploding out of it. And he does a great job of playing outside of his frame. He doesn't let the ball get on his body a lot. So now he has a 6'5" radius where now it's like a 7-footer. So, I mean, you basically have a 7-foot guy running around the football field. That's just so tough to guard. And, I mean, just as far as receiving goes, he's a wide receiver in a tight end's body.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that pick, obviously. Kelce's one of the top tight ends, and in the previous 4 or 5 years, he's been the tight end outside of Rob Gronkowski. But for me, I'm going to take George Kittle. He's Travis Kelce, but younger, and he has the ability to block. Last year, Travis Kelce was the only starting tight end in the NFL with 5, or in the top 5 run-blocking grades. Which means a lot. That's something that we haven't seen in terms of tight ends since the very beginning of Rob Gronkowski's career. So that's elite company that George Kittle's in, and that's something that isn't really focused on too much when you look at tight ends, but that running element is really important, especially when you look at the run success that they've had in San Francisco where he plays. At 6'5", he's only an inch or so shorter than Kelce, so the size is obviously about the same. And his production is awesome. I mean, he's had really a great year in the past 2 years. And he is a lot younger, so he has a lot more room for growth. He had 1,050 receiving yards last year and 5 touchdowns. 85 catches is quite a lot, especially when you're blocking for the running backs as well. But to me, the element that stands out is that blocking, because if your tight end's blocking, then your running backs are going to chip for your quarterback and your wide receivers are going to block the guys. And that's just setting an example for the rest of the team. And I think that's really a key element in San Francisco's running success this past season. And, I mean, if you have a guy that can, when you were just talking about Travis Kelce, just the ability to catch the ball and get open and all that, but if you can have a guy that can do all of that stuff, maybe to a little bit of a less extent, but also block and provide that extra strength on your offensive line without having to bring in an extra tackle, then that's just really invaluable. I mean, it's so necessary to have high success at the NFL, and the 49ers just showed that this throughout this season with their great running attack.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that's that's probably a good pick with George Kittle. I mean, obviously that blocking is definitely a big part of his game. So now we're gonna.
My linebacker would be Darius Leonard. Might be a little biased because I am an Indianapolis Colts fan, but he's been phenomenal. Last season he had 5 interceptions, 5 sacks, and 120 tackles. That just shows the versatility that he has to be able to play all over the field. And I mean, last year in his rookie season, he had 163 tackles, which led the NFL. He's only 24 years old. It's his second season this past season. So he obviously has a ton of room for growth. The 7 interceptions in his career really stand out, because there's some linebackers that don't ever get interceptions. And the ball-hawking ability of this young linebacker is really appealing. And just that success early in his career really just set him up for a trajectory to have a great NFL career. 71 solo tackles last year is really high. I mean, he had 120 total tackles, but 71 is, I wouldn't say elite company, but it's up there above average in terms of NFL tackling production. And just his leadership, I mean, I haven't experienced this directly at all, but I've read some stories about how he's kind of rallied the guys within that locker room together. It hasn't equated to any actual success yet in terms of the Indianapolis Colts, but he does bring a leadership presence, and he's not just a quiet guy that goes out there and gets the work done. He also motivates the other guys. That's something that you always want to have on your team.
Yeah, I think personally that wasn't really biased. That's probably who I would have gone with. I think he's probably the best young linebacker, so I'll take, in my opinion, the second best young linebacker in Jalen Smith. He's still just 24 years old. In 2019, he had 142 tackles, which was 7th in the NFL, and 108 solo tackles, which was tied 2nd in the league. He also had 6 tackles for loss and 2.5 sacks and 2 forced fumbles. So, I mean, he's a great pass rusher. He's a great coverage linebacker and run defender, so he can do it all at the middle linebacker position. He's also really smart and can dissect the play really well of what the offense is doing. And he also has really incredible speed despite tearing both his ACL and MCL in college. And in 2018, according to Pro Football Focus, he had the best pass rush win percentage in the NFL, and he was a top 3 coverage linebacker as well. So he can pretty much just do it all, and he's also a great leader just overall on defense, and you can really build your entire defense around him.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a great pick as well. Some of the other guys that we were looking at include...
I had Leighton Vander Esch, Deion Jones, and Tremaine Edmonds were 3 of the guys that I was considering outside of that. I don't know if you had anyone else.
I mean, obviously the one that just retired is Luke Kuechly.
Yeah.
One of the best to ever play. And another one I was considering was Bobby Wagner. But the only reason that I didn't take him is because he is a lot older. I believe he's 31 years of age. So he's not set up for the future, but he is one of the best linebackers in the league right now.
Yeah.
So moving on to defensive linemen.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this one's pretty easy. I'm going to take Aaron Donald, still just 28 years old. He's the best defensive lineman in the NFL right now. Last year he had 12.5 sacks, which was 7th in the NFL but 1st among interior defensive linemen, 20 tackles for loss, which was the best in the NFL, 55 quarterback pressures, and 24 QB hits. He's a 5-time first-team All-Pro, and this is a really interesting stat I found. He was double or triple-teamed on 319 snaps, which was 34% of the snaps he played, which was the most in the NFL. The most in the NFL that was double or triple teamed. And he beat those double or triple teams 18.2% of the time, which was also the best in the NFL. So he's getting double or tripled the most in the NFL and beating it the most in the NFL, which is pretty unbelievable. He's an elite pass rusher and an elite run defender. He'll just go around stronger linemen or go through quicker ones. He has so many different moves he can pull on you, and, I mean, he's just the most disruptive lineman we've seen in the NFL in a long time.
Yeah, I mean, I can't argue with that at all. In terms of disruption, he is the example. There's not anybody that can plug up the middle of a defense as well as he can. I really like that stat about the double teams, and 18% of the time he actually gets through them, which is unheard of. For me, I'm going to pick Nick Bosa because of his age. I mean, this is only his first NFL season. He's so young. He had 9 sacks last year, 47 total tackles. So not a great year in terms of production. He did have 5 sacks in the postseason last year. He clearly got to play more games than everybody else, but that is significant. He plays on a great defensive line, so that might play into his production as a young rookie. But if he's able to improve on what he's already done, then I believe that he could be a cornerstone of a franchise in the future. And the only real question with Nick Bosa so far is whether or not he needs help around him to get it done, or if it's just the production is helping him around him to add to his own production. So it's just about removing the guys around him and placing him alone, essentially how Aaron Donald has to play, and seeing if he can have that same sort of impact. But, yeah, I mean, Nick Bosa isn't as good or won't be as good as Aaron Donald, but I think he's set up for the future to have a really nice career and pressure the quarterback a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a great pick. He was a Defensive Rookie of the Year, and he's probably the best up-and-coming lineman in the NFL right now. The other guys I was considering were Myles Garrett, T.J. Watt, and then Danielle Hunter, and just all young, talented guys that are able to pressure the quarterback.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, his brother, Joey Bosa, isn't as known, but he's just as good.
Mm-hmm.
And then Eric Armstead is also extremely good. He plays for the San Francisco 49ers as well.
Yeah, so now we're going to move on to our last position, defensive back. So who was your pick for this?
So my pick would be Jamal Adams. In his third season, he's just a really versatile player. I don't think that he is the best defensive back, but with the combination of age and versatility, being able to play all over the field, I thought that he would set my team up best for success in the future. He had 6.5 sacks and 12.5 disrupted dropbacks this previous season. He played 46% of his snaps at safety, which is his listed position. He played 37% of his snaps at outside linebacker, 10% in the slot, and 3% at the corner and the inside linebacker position. So just this combination of speed, jumping ability, being able to tackle these guys. He hasn't had very many interceptions, only 2 in his career, but I think that ball-hawking ability only come. I mean, he's built for it. You saw it at LSU where he was just a playmaker flying all over the field and stuff like that, where, I mean, he's knocking guys off their feet and just disrupting passes and stuff and he's just really a talented player. But overall, just his flexibility on defense, giving that defensive coordinator an opportunity to play 3 safeties out there, or only play 1, or just mix up defensive looks, as he's really just a hybrid safety.
Yeah, I think that's a really good pick. And I was actually at the Jets draft party when he got drafted, and all the Jets fans there were ecstatic about that because they knew the type of player they were getting. So for my defensive back, I'm going to go with Jalen Ramsey. He's 25 years old, and now he's on the Los Angeles Rams. Didn't have a great 2019 year, just 1 interception and 5 passes defended, but I mean, that was a year filled with drama between whether he was going to get traded or not from Jacksonville, and then you know, the fit in LA is a bit questionable whether, you know, the scheme is right for him. But, I mean, he's still an elite quarterback in the NFL where, I mean, I'd say at the worst he's top five, probably top three. And, I mean, I think he can still shadow any number one receiver in the NFL and shut them down. And, I mean, just going back 2 years ago to 2018, he had 13 passes defended and 3 interceptions. So I think 2019 was more of just a fluke where he had 3 really good years of production and 1 not-so-good year. And, I mean, if you have one cornerback that can just shadow an offense's number one receiver, that makes your defense a lot easier to scheme around and a lot better. So that's why I went with cornerback here instead of a safety like Jamal Adams. And it's such a position where there aren't, it's a position where there aren't a lot of shutdown guys like him. So I think just having one is huge because there aren't many true elite cornerbacks today. And the other DBs I was looking at were Tre'Davious White, Marcus Peters, Marlon Humphrey, Jaire Alexander, and Anthony Harris.
Yeah, I mean, I really like that pick of Jalen Ramsey because obviously shutting down one position is really meaningful. The other guys that I was looking at is Stephon Gilmore. Obviously, he's a little older.
Yeah.
Jaire Alexander, Quandre Diggs, and Marcus Peters. But those are just some of the – I mean, there's obviously so many great – defensive lineman, but the one that I was really close to picking would be Minkah Fitzpatrick. He, from his trade from the Dolphins to the Steelers, really flipped that defense around. With all their quarterback injuries and just question marks throughout the season, they were not playing too great, and they almost secured a playoff spot with that defensive play throughout the remainder of the season. So I think that he'll have a major impact in Pittsburgh for the rest of his career.
Yeah, I think that would have been a good pick, too. He's a young superstar, and he had a great season last year. So now we're just going to – you just want to say all the players on your team, and then I'll do the same with mine?
Yeah, so I have Russell Wilson, Saquon Barkley, DeAndre Hopkins, Chris Godwin, George Kittle, Nick Bosa, Darius Leonard, and Jamal Adams.
So mine was Deshaun Watson, Christian McCaffrey, Michael Thomas, Devontae Adams, Aaron Donald, Jalen Smith, Jalen Ramsey, and Travis Kelce is my tight end. I like my team better than yours.
Well, I wish there was a way to simulate this or put it out there. But yeah, I mean, this was really fun. This was just a kind of less traditional way, since we only had 2 people today, to just bring up some sports topics that we normally wouldn't get to talk about. So thank you guys for listening, and we'll be back next week.
Yep, thank you guys.